please. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention. The court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-3106. United States of America, Larry A. Cruz, Jr. and Health.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stephen LaCar for appellant. I've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, I want to argue 2 points this morning with the court's permission. One is Batson, and the other issue is Ms. Joinder. I'm prepared to answer any questions related to the other issues raised in this appeal. Insofar as Batson's concerned, we start with something unusual, the challenge rate. The pool was 50-50. Yet the government used 73%.
Can you pull that lectern up a little bit so the mic's closer to you? Yeah.
Thanks. Your Honor. We start with the fact that the pool was 50-50, yet the government's challenge rate was 73%.
Let me make sure I understand the context, though. The pool's 32-32, is that right?
I think that's right.
And
64.
And the veneerman, the jury seated is 9-9.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it's hard to see how you have a problem going from 32-9 on each side of the color line.
Well, random. If one were to flip coins randomly, one would assume that the government strikes would have been equal or somewhat close to that, but that's not the case. So 17 out of 22 of their strikes were exercised against minorities. That's a challenge rate case. So I certainly agree.
Case, I'm sorry?
Challenge rate.
No, you said, the government. Referring to a particular case.
That's right. No, their strikes were 17 out of 22. And if you focus just on the two African Americans who were timely challenged, there are some things that strike us as rather puzzling. We look at all the circumstances, as Snyder commands us to do, and I'll start with 408, the minister who the government struck. They gave three statements below. They said that she was opposed to capital punishment, but that's inconsistent because there were at least four whites who also said they were somewhat opposed to capital punishment, and a fifth who said that she was leaning against it. They said that this minister would be sympathetic to drug users. Well, one has to look at the strike. Does it fit the case to be tried? I think that's the lesson of Kessler versus Canberra. And in this case, that excuse didn't fit. This wasn't a possession case.
Let me go back to the first question.
Sure.
You got from 32-9 on each side.
That's right.
Through a combination of peremptory strikes.
That's right.
Strikes for cause.
That's right.
Anything else? That's it, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So if the strikes, the strikes for cause take it down somewhat, and then the peremptories are used as they are.
17 of 22.
Putting aside what I think is a separate point that you make about the comparison of the two jurors, just looking at that, because you make the at least imply in your brief that just the challenge rate is itself a problem.
I don't say that that's in and of itself enough. I think it suggests to us that something more puzzling, maybe something more suspect may be afoot. And then when we start with that and we look to the reasons that were given, the inconsistencies, the facts that the excuses don't fit the case to be tried, and that some of the excuses are late blooming, then the pattern becomes a little bit more clear. And of course, as we all know, the strike of one African American for racially suspect reasons would violate Batson.
Right, so is it fair to say that your argument is that the challenge rate puts the court on inquiry notice?
I think that's right.
That's all it does.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, Your Honor. Juror number 408, the minister, would be likely to be sympathetic towards drug users. This wasn't a use case. This was a case involving allegations of racketeering and violent crime. There was no suggestion in the record. Nobody ever asked her any, the prosecutor didn't ask her any questions below that suggested that, as to the issue of sympathy. Now, they've given a late blooming excuse.
You don't think it's a plausible inference?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You don't think it's a plausible inference? Not an inference so strong that you know for a fact, but a subject of reasonable concern to a lawyer picking a jury.
Reasonable concern? That
reasonable inference that nature of her job was such as to create a general sympathy and possibly, therefore, to excuse conduct that others would not excuse.
No, not in this case, Your Honor. Let me explain why. If you look at her juror questionnaire, there's no indication that she belonged to any denomination that preached forgiveness. And one can certainly think, if I can make an allusion to...
I don't think that... The theory of the... the stated theory of the prosecution was that the nature of her work would almost necessarily create sympathy for drug users, and that the sympathy for drug users could spill over in various ways.
Well, certainly nobody ever asked her any questions about that, Your Honor. And again, this was not a drug use case. It was, and they're cooperators. They're cooperators. It cuts both ways. As I pointed out in our reply brief, their cooperators were largely heavy drug users, so it would cut both ways if that were true.
Right.
And also, why would they bring up here at this stage of the case? Well, we thought that she might have sympathy for Larry Gooch's foster mother, Pat Wills. Pat Wills wasn't ever listed as a witness in the case, and her name didn't appear in the juror questionnaire. So insofar as juror 408, this is not a woman who had had indicated sympathy for people who use drugs. And if there were some inference to that, I suspect, again, that it cuts both ways.
But, I mean, when we're reviewing now, we're looking at the district court's explanation as to why it was or was not acceptable, right?
We're looking to that. That's correct.
All right. So it doesn't matter whether they're embellishing in their brief to us, because our review is focused on the district court's explanation.
That's true, Your Honor, except that I think if they tip the district court offside with some of their explanations, I think we have to look to that. We look to all the facts in the record. Let me give you, how about Juror 854, the legal secretary? There they said, well, she's 28 years old, but they're very inconsistent. They took three whites who were in their late 20s.
Isn't she the laugher?
She the what, Your Honor?
She the laugher.
There's no indication.
Had a giggly 28-year-old. They said they didn't think she was very mature. The judge thought that was a reasonable.
Odd times.
Yeah.
That is the perfect example of a district court judge who's sitting there watching this says, if I'm prosecutor or I'm the attorney, and this is a potential juror, I don't want this person on the jury.
That would seem so in the first case. Let me tell you why it doesn't work here, Your Honor. Because the district court also went along with the driving while black theory. That is not a race-neutral excuse. That's a concern.
Well,
it was close to what was said.
There are an awful lot of whites who accept the proposition that there's a very high incidence and a incidence of arrests of blacks while driving that could only be explained by bias. So why isn't that race neutral?
Okay. In this case, we suggest a stereotyping afoot. Let me explain why. She said most cops were good. There were a few who weren't good. The district judge said that
went
was...
went on to warning her nephew about the problems of driving, right?
I think most people are concerned when they're stopped by the police, Your Honor. It's not an equal situation.
Well, she wrapped it up in an explanation which... though not using the magic words, driving while black, came about as close as you could to that without using those magic words.
That's true, except that this wasn't race neutral. Somebody openly expressed that. The prosecutor said it's driving while black, and our position is that's stereotyping. That's thinking that blacks are going to automatically discredit the police. That's not what she said.
It was. She didn't say, I'm going to discredit the police. She said that or you wouldn't be bothering with her here.
No.
What she said in a pithy way, what she had said. Now, and it is certainly a proposition not confined to blacks, although probably held more commonly by blacks than by whites.
That's a historical, I think that's a sociological phenomenon. That's true, that African-Americans tend to have distrust of the police. But here, look what she said. Look what she said in the voir dire. And what she said, Judge Williams, is this. Most cops are good, not all are good. White said the same thing. There was a white who said, you can't believe the police finally. She commended the police. She commended the police for what they had done in apprehending a group of thugs in her neighborhood. The district judge said, that's a great comment when she said, that was the district judge's word, and said she might have taken her for the jury but she did refer to the laughter. I want to address that. The demeanor cases, Your Honor, tend to go off on this issue. Is there an evidence of hostility? I'll give you an example. There are demeanor cases where a juror crossed his or her arms or wore a Malcolm X hat in front of the court. And that suggested there was some hostility towards law enforcement. Judge Collier said on the record she couldn't point to anything specific about laughter. But laughter is a neutral factor. It could cut both ways. If it were just laughter.
It doesn't suggest someone who will listen carefully to the evidence and decide on the basis of the evidence.
I think, Your Honor, most lay people who go into court for the first time are going to be nervous. That's just the nature of the setting.
You know, I don't think it follows, Mr. Lecker, that because something could cut either way, it's a neutral factor.
Then why did...
Because it's a risk. It introduces a risk, and if the government's trying to avoid the risk, the fact that it's a 50-50 risk doesn't really mitigate the problem.
Let me suggest you look at it this way, Your Honor. Let's look at if this was a standard Title VII case. Let's ask ourselves, why would the government need to gin up a pretext like age or youth in this case when they were taking whites for the same reason? Why would they take a position as they did?
Were they laughing whites?
They said they struck her because of her age. She's 28.
There's a combination of things. But the laughing, the driving while black, is that the same juror? And the laughing were the things that they seemed to move on. I think it was the judge who actually...
I think it was the judge who actually
added age as a consideration. I'm not sure the government
raised
that.
The prosecutor did mention age.
Maybe the judges picked that up and reinforced it. But so you've got... somebody who seems to, as the courts have laughed at inappropriate times, right? Maybe is trying to ingratiate herself, maybe isn't following what's going on, introduces a risk. They don't want to take it.
Our view of it is that the way the government, its explanations just didn't make sense in the circumstances. I see that I'm going into my rebuttal time, Your Honor.
Could you address the waiver and plain error issue? Because as I understand it, we have the day coming to an end. We've discussed the challenges that you had made. You weren't counsel.
I was not trial counsel.
Counsel below. Raised the issue of additional matters, specifically the question of comparison with what he suggested might be similarly situated whites.
That's true.
And the judge very clearly says, all right, take overnight to look at that, and I expect to hear from you. I don't quite understand the business about coming in blue jeans because it is going to be another sitting day, but anyway, clearly ready to make time for whatever counsel has to say.
She did do that.
And counsel comes back with nothing. Now, does that not look like an intentional relinquishment of a known right?
No. Does it look like there's a superficial inference to that effect, except that they made other challenges? There are cases such as United States versus Deborah Brown, that Second Circuit case, that stand for the proposition that on appeal, one can raise a plain error where there are other African Americans in a Batson case, where trial counsel should have raised it but didn't raise it. So I don't see this as a waiver.
Well,
I'm troubled.
Different from the lion's share of cases, because there is this explicit invitation. Counsel seems to indicate that he gets the picture and will do what has to be done, and he doesn't do anything. Does he have to announce, I have no additional objections? What more is required as a practical matter?
I think what more is required? These are constitutional rights. The error was the issue was raised below as to two people.
Right.
On appeal, it's easy to evaluate whether there was plain error or not with respect to the factors. You've got the voir dire in front of you. You've got the juror questionnaires in front of you. You can evaluate the record.
You don't have any effort, any visible effort by the government to explain with reference to arguably similarly situated unstricken whites. So that part, whatever the government might have had to say on that, is lost.
Well, that's troubling. I agree with you, Your Honor.
Mr. Lecker, we will give you back your time for rebuttal. But before you sit down, tell me what it means. What is all this reference to driving while black?
What does it mean to driving while black?
Yeah.
It wasn't fleshed out in the record to suggest, but what it appears to be.
She didn't use the phrase. The government later uses it, right? So what does it convey? What is the idea?
What it conveys is a stereotype belief that African Americans are going to discredit the police because they're afraid that if they're going to be stopped by the police more likely than not are going to be of the majority class as compared to minorities who aren't going to look very sympathetically on blacks.
I think you're using it as a to make a point rather than just telling me what it is. It seems to me what it is a perception held by whomever that blacks are more likely to be stopped for no reason other than because they're going to be stopped for no reason other than their race. Isn't that the idea?
I think that's one way of looking at it. What she said was she told her advice to her nephews is, you don't know what's going to be out there. Be careful if you get stopped. And I think what she
also said that. Correct.
I think that is what she said, but it was the prosecution.
Well, here's what she said. Why I said also, because here's what she said that seems to me more directly pertinent. I have been pulled over a couple of times, something like that. I have brothers in. You're a black man. You're driving. You're going to get pulled over. You know. Now that is driving while black, almost in terms, is it not?
I think that's right.
All right. So the government was not off base when they paraphrased that.
No, that's
phrase.
Not. Okay. They're not.
Right.
But they stereotype. They believe that she's going to automatically vote against law enforcement.
I have the point. How much time had you reserved?
I had reserved 4 minutes, Your Honor.
Restore that.
I did want to address Ms. Joinder, but I guess...
If it comes up,
okay.
If it doesn't, you'll have time.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Elizabeth Gabriel on behalf of the United States. The district court did not commit any error, clear or plain, in denying appellant's Batson challenge. The government provided race-neutral explanations for each of its strikes, and appellant accepted almost all of those explanations. His argument on appeal now rests on a post hoc comparative analysis claim, which he expressly asked for time to raise in the district court, was given that time, and failed to raise it. Given those circumstances, it cannot be said that the district court clearly or plainly erred in rejecting appellant's challenge.
Well, but there are allusions in the cases to the proposition that we don't even have jurisdiction over the issue if it was waived. And you understandably raise the waiver issue. So at least to the extent that those cases are controlling, we would have to decide waiver or no waiver.
Are you talking about just a run-of-the-mill forfeiture by inaction?
No, I'm not talking about
waiver.
Forfeiture. I'm talking
waiver.
About waiver.
Okay.
As opposed to plain error analysis.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Absolutely.
But you're arguing plain error analysis. You did so far.
We argue plain error analysis for the most part in our brief. We do assert that appellant did waive many of his Batson claims with respect to the...
Do you have any case law in this circuit that says it's closed out? I mean, waiver is normally understood to be an explicit, that's the easiest case, I'm done. It can be implicit given the circumstance. Is there anything in our case law that would take this circumstance and say, though, that's not forfeiture or plain error, that's waiver?
I don't believe that the circuit has ever addressed that particular situation in the Batson context. But it's clear from the record here that appellant specifically asked the court and told the court that defense counsel said he needed more time, he needed at least overnight to conduct a comparative analysis, that he believed it was his duty to do so. The court said, fine, file something in writing so that we can all talk about it.
I'm not sure where that fits in the plain error. That's what I'm struggling with. So how does that fit in the plain error analysis? That is, if you're calling it sloppy advocacy or irresponsible advocacy or whatever. So where does that fit? Because the plain error analysis assumes someone didn't do something, and then we look at it. So what difference does it make that they had an opportunity and didn't do it? That's more a waiver type argument. You say there's no case law in the circuit for that. How are you playing this into the plain error analysis?
Well, I think that particularly with respect to his comparative analysis, his argument that these strikes were invalid because there were similarly situated whites, that argument was certainly waived. He asked for the opportunity to raise it. He failed to do so. Now, his challenge to the government strikes, we believe he did, of course, raise a Batson challenge. The government did provide its explanations, and appellant didn't challenge the majority of those explanations. With respect to those, the general challenge of those strikes that he didn't further challenge, those would be subject to plain error review.
You're drawing a distinction between the issue of comparisons with arguably similarly situated whites, on the one hand, that argument, and the unmentioned, stricken black jurors?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's because of the exact words in the colloquy before the overnight recess?
That's correct. It's the government's position that this court should not consider a comparative analysis here in this appeal when appellant essentially didn't raise one, although he said that he would or wished to have some more time to do so. So with respect to that specific argument that there's a comparative analysis here that would support his Batson claim, we believe that he has waived that analysis, and this court should not entertain that.
But for the six other jurors, you go on plain error?
Well,
only on plain error.
If his argument with respect to those jurors is limited only to a comparative analysis, then it's our position that he has waived that analysis.
Well, he certainly waived the comparative analysis as to those, and I suppose you're right. If that's all he has to go on with respect to those six, then that wraps them up too. Yeah.
But you're not resting on any law in this circuit on waiver?
No, Your Honor, not in this particular, in the context of a Batson challenge, no.
Didn't you file a 28-J letter on this?
I'm sorry.
Moore, didn't you file a letter?
I did file a letter.
Was that on a different point?
That did deal with Batson and the joinder issue. In Moore, the court applied a plain error analysis. Of course, in Moore, the context was a little different because a comparative analysis had been somewhat raised below, but not with respect to all of the challenge strikes. But Moore makes clear that where a defendant has not suggested that there are similarly situated whites to the district court cannot be faulted for not noticing similarities among seated white jurors. And that's essentially the case we have here. Now, appellant has had, post-trial months and months to pour over the record, to read through voir dire, to look through the questionnaires, to find those particular alleged similarities. The district court, of course, was dealing with the situation in the moment. Now, counsel alerted the court to his desire to present a comparative analysis argument in support of his claim and didn't do so. We can't ask the district court necessarily or fault the district court for not doing so when it wasn't squarely presented to the court.
Yeah, well, see, that's where it gets circular again, because that's always the context in plain error. District court's never had a shot at it in a plain error case. I mean, by definition, that's what a plain error case is. So, I'm trying to understand your argument on the plain error analysis as best I can understand it. It's not plain. In other words, we can look at it under a plain error analysis, and I think what you're saying is when you look at it, Your Honors, is it's certainly not plain error. There's a debate there, but it's not plain, and so it ought to go down. Hadn't been raised, and are you saying the fourth factor as well, that is, there's no injustice here in any event, or you're not going there?
I wouldn't go that far. I don't think that there's any authority to support that, but our argument is that the any error here, if there were error, would not be plain. Certainly the government's explanations were supported by the record. The court had the opportunity to review, and it's apparent from the court's ruling on those jurors that were specifically challenged, that the court did take notes, did look back at the voir dire, and was very conscientious in determining whether or not the prosecutor's explanations were reasonable and justified. And so here, the court certainly can't be faulted for not conducting an analysis that that appellant didn't present. Now, I can speak about any particular jurors if the court has any questions. Otherwise, I would just rest on our brief. I'll entertain any other questions, of course, that the court may have.
Yes, I'd like to ask about the joinder issue.
Would you rather hear from Mr. Lecker on that?
Well, no, this may be her last chance. The two of the counts, at least, two of the counts relating to Cunningham and Lane refer to a purpose that's part of the overall drug conspiracy, right? They refer to that in conclusory terms. And as I read nicely, it's nicely, I think, as I read nicely, it suggests that you look at either the indictment or facts produced in a pretrial hearing, but if the government's showing is weak, possibly it can be saved by what happened at trial. Possibly. Seems to me that the court, if I'm reading nicely correctly, just alludes to this as a mere possibility. In other words, it doesn't rule in or rule out what happens at trial. It's just a contingent discussion. So if we're looking at what's happening before trial, here we have a conclusory assertion and nothing else. Is that enough? And are there cases saying it's enough?
There are
a conclusory assertion in the indictment.
There are cases saying that it's enough. I think nicely is a bit confusing on the point. Nicely doesn't really say either way. Nicely starts out saying you look to the indictment and the pretrial representations, and then of course goes on to consider the trial evidence. So it's a little confusing in terms of setting forth what the court is to consider. But this court's subsequent cases, including Carson and Moore, make it absolutely clear, and Spriggs, that the question of joinder is determined solely from the face of the indictment and pretrial representations.
Okay, but when we are looking solely at those, what do we find here as compared with other cases?
Well, the indictment here alleges that the Cunningham Lane offenses were committed as overt acts in furtherance of the RICO and narcotics conspiracies.
And it gives no detail explaining that link, right?
It doesn't go into detail. Of course, as overt acts in the indictment, it states that these offenses, during the course of these offenses, appellant and his co-defendants obtained money and drugs, which, of course, were the goals of this conspiracy. Now, I don't know if the indictments in Carson, Moore, Spriggs were equally, specific or non-specific. It's hard to say, but certainly for the purposes of joinder, which is determined pre-trial, those allegations were sufficient to establish the logical relationship between those crimes and the charged conspiracies. And that's the only question.
You don't actually have a case that says that, do you?
I don't believe the case law talks in terms of this degree of specificity of the allegations. I think that the case law makes it, simply says that if there are such allegations, if the facts are alleged that these crimes are part of the common scheme, then that in itself is enough. And then the question of whether or not the facts actually play out at trial, that's an issue that goes to severance
right. And
prejudice.
Clearly.
And Moore makes it clear, and I'll quote from the opinion, says, if the indictment establishes proper joinder, trial evidence cannot render joinder impermissible and is thus irrelevant.
It is a little troubling, isn't it, if a conclusory statement in the indictment completely eliminates the joinder issue?
Well, I think that...
That puts it virtually in the hands of the government to just give its ipsy-dixit.
Well, certainly there are consequences for misjoinder. The government joins offenses.
Well, not if the government uses the right words in the indictment.
But the consequences can be great. The government misjoins counts at its peril. In a case like this, where it was a 3-month trial, a multi-count indictment, the outcome of a severance or a mistrial because of prejudice is certainly a great consequence, enough to deter the government from simply throwing in any offense that it wishes.
Yeah, except that all that is reviewed, deferentially to the district court, and the burden of proof of showing prejudice is on the defendant. So things have flipped to the advantage of the government if it gets over that first, the Rule 8 hurdle.
That is correct. That is correct. Yeah. But I think that the Rule 8 was established with a view towards basically liberal joinder, and with the view that the determination of whether joinder is proper is a determination that's made before the government is required to put on its evidence. The government isn't required to show to establish any specific evidence to show that its counts were properly joined.
And so there wasn't a factual hearing in this case on the joinder issue, was there?
Not a factual hearing. There was a
discussion.
There was
awesome.
Argument.
Right.
Sure.
So it's your position, I take it, that as long as an offense is said to be in furtherance of a conspiracy alleged in another count, the government's home free.
Yes, if there are allegations in the indictment that would establish the logical relationship between
those
crimes.
No, all there is this assertion that crime B was in furtherance of the conspiracy to commit crimes A through Z.
Certainly, I think if the the framework of the indictment establishes that this is not a completely unrelated crime.
What if the indictment established that?
Well, in the indictment, in terms of the allegations of the conspiracy itself, the indictment sets forth that the principal goal of both of these conspiracies was to gain as many things of value and as much money as possible for the conspirators to enrich themselves. In terms of the RICO conspiracy, it specifically spelled out that the conspirators committed crimes such as murder, robbery, burglary, assault with intent to kill in furtherance of that goal.
But the burglary in question is the Cunningham Lane burglary, correct?
It is.
So that doesn't add anything.
That's
another way of saying it was in furtherance of the conspiracy.
It was enumerated in the indictment, and for a district court that's looking at the question of whether there's proper joinder without having any of the evidence at trial to consider, certainly on its face the indictment establishes that logical relationship. Now, of course,
didn't your pretrial offering say that in connection with the Cunningham and Lane murders, they were committed in conjunction with a plan to steal money which would benefit both the enterprise and the culprits and enhance their own standing within the enterprise?
That's correct.
Well, but I mean, I think you, for the last 5 minutes, you haven't been making the connection in answer to the questions that have been raised. It sounds like you were just resting on all we have to say is a conspiracy and in furtherance of, and nothing more. And I think, as I read your pretrial materials, you tied it up. I mean, it's not at great length, but you tried to tie it up with this is what we do, and that's what they did. They stole money here to enhance the enterprise, part of the conspiracy, and their own standing in the enterprise. It's an execution-style murder. This was an execution-style murder, typical of what was going on in the conspiracy.
That's correct. The government did provide pretrial representations that supported its allegations in the indictment, and the district court relied on both of those things, the pretrial representations and the indictment.
And then you mean to say, I think, that you can't ask us to do anything more than that, Your Honors, unless someone confessed in advance and we can give you that.
I think that's true. I thought that's what you were trying to say. Thank you, Your Honor. I think the cases make clear that that the government isn't required to put on evidence at the point that the question of joinder is raised.
Could you now try to say what would be a crime as to which the government could not say it was in furtherance of the conspiracy because from it the perpetrators reaped either money or status?
Well, I suppose one could imagine if, for example, there were an allegation that appellant assaulted his girlfriend and stole her money.
So that yielded money and perhaps status.
Well, not necessarily. In this case,
no, but you could allege that with sufficient plausibility, well, right? And it shows that people aren't to fool around with him, girls or anyone else, and he's ruthless, and you better watch out.
I suppose that could be a situation. I would distinguish it, of course, from what we have here, because here they stole not only money but drugs, and the drugs were packaged for sale.
Was the drug theft in the indictment?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was the theft of the drugs from the Cunningham Lane apartment in the indictment as a separate or mentioned at all?
It was mentioned. It was. Okay. It was mentioned that they that appellant and his co-defendants burglarized, robbed, and killed Cunningham and Lane, and obtained money and drugs. How much drugs? I don't think it was quantified at trial, but there was testimony that they were packaged in small zips.
In the indictment, was there any indication?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
No. But
as it turned out, it looks like it was a personal use quantity.
I'm sorry.
As it turned out, I believe the quantity was such that it would have been attributed to Cunningham or Lane's personal use rather than a wholesale quantity.
I don't think that that's necessarily true. I don't know that there was any evidence of that.
Well, it was a small bag is what we were told.
It was a bag with smaller Ziplocs within the bag.
I see. So
it was packaged for sale.
Yeah.
And as we know, crack cocaine was the primary drug that was being sold by M Street Crew at that time. So those facts certainly support the propriety of joinder here as well.
Further questions?
Mm-mm.
Thank you, Ms. Gabriel.
Thank you.
Mr. Leckar, if you want to talk about joinder, this is a good time.
And I have 1 minute to address Judge Edwards' question about observation about plain error. The 28J letter cites United States versus Moore. To some extent, this is alumni weekend for me. I was the counsel for Kevin Gray in that case, and we did raise plain error, and the court went through them. And it was part of the record below. So you can't evaluate them for plain error. I'm not asking you, I am asking you to agree with us.
Of course, we know we do that all the time, as Judge Edwards said.
Right. I want to address something you said, Judge Williams, because you're right on target. It is troubling with these conclusory allegations in the indictment. It's more than troubling because John Richardson, case United States versus John Richardson, citing United States versus Jackson, says local law crimes, the Cunningham Lane burglary, local law crimes, they're jurisdictional in nature. You can consider the evidence at trial as well as what's pretrial representations and the indictment. I want to talk about Cunningham Lane. The district judge said, boy, these allegations are vague. That's her words. And what the prosecutor said at the hearing was, well, I was committed to make money. Well, you don't have to look too much farther than United States versus Nicely to understand.
Counsel just said that government counsel at trial also represented that it was done to put fellow participants in fear of what would happen if they stepped out of line.
I don't think that was let me tell you what the evidence
I may
said.
Have made that slightly more precise than the representation of the representation, but that seemed to be the gist of it.
I read a representation to be two things, that reputation, as to which there was no evidence at trial, that this bolstered anybody's reputation or standing, as I pointed out in the briefs. The evidence was...
But you are accepting the proposition that it was represented in advance, that this was to bolster their reputation.
Well, that's reputation, yes, yes.
Yeah.
And they had no evidence of that. Here's what the evidence showed. It was going to be a burglary.
I want to know where you are. On the joinder question, we look to what they put in the indictment and their pretrial offerings.
And the evidence at trial. And the evidence at trial. I've cited a series of cases, both in my opening brief and in our reply brief, that say you look to the evidence at trial, particularly where you have local law counts that are jurisdictional in nature, as they did here with Cunningham Lane.
Now, does that go to severance or joinder?
Both.
I don't know how it can go to both if joinder is evaluated, the trial judge is evaluating the request for joinder before trial is started.
And I'm saying that I understand that nicely, John Richardson and Jackson looked to the evidence to find out, to ascertain whether there was any validity to the prosecutor's representations.
Well, that's a severance question, isn't it?
Both. They addressed it.
I don't understand that conceptually. How can it be the trial judge's order with respect to joinder, which is now in review, is taken after the indictment and pretrial offerings? That's all the trial judge had.
That's right.
So I don't know how we can attack a trial judge's ruling when all the trial judge has and could have is the indictment and the pretrial offerings on the joinder. Seems to me, I don't know what these, I'll have to go back and look at the cases again, but it seems to me the analysis is a little off to suggest beyond the severance question, well, what, we can retroactively say that the joinder question was decided incorrectly because what we found out in trial was that the offerings were wrong?
That's what the case law suggests, Your Honor. And if, even under Your Honor's interpretation, plainly under this case should have been seven, it was a timely motion for seven.
I think Carson says you only look at the indictment and pretrial offerings under Rule 8. I think we're clear on that. That's what Carson says.
And I suggested to his attention with Carson because it's earlier Alumni Weekend again.
No attention with me because that seems just eminently correct. I'm not tense about that.
Well, all right.
It makes no sense otherwise to say otherwise. And Carson said there may be some confusion here, but let's look at this clear-headedly. The only way you can analyze joinder is indictment and pretrial. That's all.
And Carson didn't focus on Jackson, and it didn't focus on John Richardson. And I'm suggesting that there is a tension in the court's decisions. One panel can't overrule the other. But under any circumstances, what you can come down and say is this, that this was they shoehorned this evidence of grisly, unrelated violence. It was a standalone episode. I want to make very clear in my remaining seconds, there was no evidence at trial. No evidence.
You're talking severance, not the abuse of discretion standard.
I'm talking both. That is an abuse of discretion.
Okay.
That's absolutely correct. I'm talking about the evidence. The evidence was that this was a burglary across town. It wasn't a burglary plan to get drugs. The testimony was that Gooch picked up some drugs that were laying out on the table, a small quantity, and then went after the episode, and got back to the apartment. Everybody was pretty solemn, pretty dull, was shaking their head. Even the cooperators who later testified about Gooch's conversation didn't say this had been done to bolster anybody's reputation or standing in the enterprise. So our view on this, it was shoehorned into the case for an obvious reason. This was a capital prosecution. They couldn't have brought this as a standalone RICO case because it was a singular episode. So they shoehorned this unrelated episode into the case. Chronologically, was early in the time covered by the allegations. And yet they presented at the very end of the case, for obvious reasons, pretty graphic violence, double homicide, and with the principle of recency, they wanted to leave that in the juror's, redounding in the juror's mind. So we view that as prejudicial. And yes, it is an abuse of discretion standard covering severance, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Lecker, as is often the case when you're here, you're appointed by the court to represent the defendant in this case. And as always, when you're here in that capacity, we really appreciate your help in that.
And if I might address the court for 10 seconds, probably on behalf of Ms. Gabriel and myself, we've enjoyed appearing in front of you, Your Honor, as win, lose, or draw. Thank you.
Okay.